Chapter 10. The Last Anti-Colonial. While soliciting Senator Ted Kennedy to endorse the presidential aspirations of Hillary Clinton rather than Barack Obama, Bill Clinton could not hide his disdain for the man who seemed to be stealing the Democratic nomination. A few years ago, he told Kennedy, this guy would have been getting us coffee. Kennedy was offended by the remark, and when it was reported in the press, some thought Clinton was being racist. In one respect, I have to agree. But in another, I can see that Clinton's point was the exact opposite. As Clinton told Kennedy, let's just be clear, the only reason you're endorsing him is because he's black. From Clinton's point of view, only a perverted sort of affirmative action could explain why people would go for a virtually unknown and for the most part unaccomplished fellow like Obama. Is this the person whose script America was ready to follow? Clinton found the situation frustrating and absolutely incredible. But the real situation is actually more incredible than Clinton ever imagined. We are today living out the script for America and the world that was dreamt up not by Obama, but by Obama's father. How do I know this? Because Obama says so himself. Reflect for a moment on the title of his book. It's not Dreams of My Father, but rather Dreams from My Father. In other words, Obama is not writing a book about his father's dreams. He is writing a book about the dreams that he got from his father. Think about what this means. The most powerful country in the world is being governed according to the dreams of a Luo tribesman of the 1950s. A polygamist who abandoned his wives, drank himself into stupors, and bounced around on two iron legs after his real legs had to be amputated because of a car crash, raging against the world for denying him the realization of his anti-colonial ambitions. This philandering, inebriated African socialist is now setting the nation's agenda through the reincarnation of his dreams in his son. The son is the one who is making it happen. But the son is, as he candidly admits, only living out his father's dream. The invisible father provides the inspiration, and the son dutifully gets the job done. Macabre, though it seems, America today is being governed by a ghost. Now we can understand why President Obama seems so distant, detached, and even bored. This is not merely a matter of acting white. It is also the result of Obama living in his time machine. Obama inherits a world of memories that harken back to continents away and wars long ago. It was a world of marauding colonial armies and guerrillas hiding in the Aberdare Mountains. It was a world of pageantry and broken dreams. In Obama's view, great men lived in those days, men who stood athwart the colonial juggernaut crying, "Stop!" Sometimes they were crushed, but their bravery lives on in the hearts of those who knew and remember them. Compared to all this, today's world of global summits and credit card bailouts and ribbon cutting seems dull and thin. In terms of sheer human drama, nothing today seems to rise to the level of the way things used to be. This is not to say Obama is ideologically passive, that he lacks an agenda. On the contrary, Obama is a man on a mission, and he is obsessed with executing that mission. He is like the lead character in a movie who has come home to find his whole family wiped out. The incident brings forth an emotional outpouring of grief and of rage. But in time, the emotions settle, leaving behind a more controlled anger combined with a steely resolve. From that point, the man's course is set. The rest of his life is dedicated to a campaign of revenge. In Obama's case, the villains are dead, and so the rage takes on a different form and settles on a different target. Rather than focus on the specific people who wronged his family, Obama is on a systematic campaign against the colonial system that destroyed his father's dreams. With a kind of suppressed fury, he is committed to keep going until he has brought that system down. And according to his father's anti-colonial ideology, which Obama has internalized for himself, That system is the military and economic power of the United States of America. For many, it still may seem too fantastic to be true, yet it is true. The great strength of our anti-colonial theory is not only its psychological plausibility, it is rooted in Obama's vivid and persuasive self-description, but also its explanatory power. The anti-colonial hypothesis explains both Obama's economic and his foreign policy. Obama's domestic and foreign agenda operate in a kind of reverse action. Obama wants to expand government power at home, even as he works to contract America's power abroad. The Weekly Standard glibly summarizes this as omnipotence at home, impotence abroad. No other theory accounts for this dual action, but ours does. It also explains lots of little things, like Obama moving the Churchill bust out of the White House, that no rival theory can even begin to do. Can our theory do even better than this? Perhaps it can. If our theory can forecast the future, if it can account for developments that occur after it has been formulated, then it satisfies the scientific criteria of both explanation and prediction. In that case, we can not only account for Obama's actions, but also tell what he is likely to do in the future. As I was completing this book, I saw news reports quoting NASA Chief Charles Bolden announcing that from now on, the primary mission of America's space agency would be to improve relations with the Muslim world. Come again? Bolden said he got the word directly from the president. He wanted me to find a way to reach out to the Muslim world and engage much more with dominantly Muslim nations to help them feel good about their historic contribution to science and math and engineering. Bolden added that the International Space Station was a kind of model for NASA's future, since it was not just a U.S. operation, but included the Russians and the Chinese. Bolden, who made these remarks in an interview with Al Jazeera, timed them to coincide with the one-year anniversary of Obama's own Cairo address to the Muslim world. Bolden's remarks provoked consternation not only among conservatives, but also among famous former astronauts Neil Armstrong and John Glenn and others involved in America's space programs. No surprise. Most people think of NASA's job as one of landing on the Moon and Mars and exploring other faraway destinations. Even some of Obama's supporters expressed puzzlement. Sure, we are all for Islamic self-esteem, and 700 or 800 years ago, the Muslims did make a couple of important discoveries. But what on earth was Obama up to here? One of England's great colonial figures was the mining magnate Cecil Rhodes, one of the few people in history to get a country, Rhodesia, named after him. Rhodes is today remembered for the diamond mining company he founded, De Beers, and also for the Rhodes Scholarship. But in his time, he commanded something of a private army. He got mixed up in the Matabele Wars and the Boer War, and his political and economic tentacles reached across most of southern Africa. At the peak of his power, Rhodes was asked by a journalist how far he intended his influence to spread. He replied, "I would annex the planets if I could. I often think of that." This is the colonial mindset carried to the final frontier. Even possession of the whole earth is not enough. You can imagine how the anti-colonialists reacted to Rhodes. Rhodes' comment can help us understand how the anti-colonial mind perceives America's space program. It is a projection of American power and arrogance into the solar system. Recall the moon landing of Apollo 13 in 1969. "One small step for man," Neil Armstrong said. "One giant leap for mankind." But that's not how the rest of the world saw it. I was 8 years old at the time and still living in my native India. I remember my grandfather telling me about how there was a great race between America and Russia to put a man on the moon, and America had won. And everybody knew it because Neil Armstrong placed the American flag on the moon. So it wasn't one giant leap for mankind, but one giant leap for the United States. It was as if that flag signified, "We Americans did this. We Americans now own the moon." I can understand how many in the Third World might see the moon landing that way, because I'm from the Third World, and that's the way I saw it. If Obama shares this view, no wonder that he wants to blunt NASA's space program, to divert it from being a symbol of American greatness to a more modest public relations operation that builds ties with Muslims and other peoples. Even when the Muslims aren't involved, Obama wants to make sure the Russians and the Chinese share the credit. Space, you see, is for human and not merely American exploration. Plug in our anti-colonial model, and what at first seems inexplicable, converting NASA into a community outreach program for Muslims, suddenly makes complete sense. Remove the theory, and it is almost impossibly difficult to account for what Obama is doing. Here's a second example to test our theory's predictive power. On August 13, 2010, just as I was reviewing the final galleys for this book, President Obama held a White House dinner celebrating the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. At the event, he praised the plan to construct a mosque and Islamic community center 2 blocks from Ground Zero, the site of the 9/11 attacks in Lower Manhattan. "This is America," Obama solemnly declared, "and our commitment to religious freedom must be unshakable. The writ of our founders must endure." This is Obama in full translation mode, blurring the issue with his usual agility. The issue raised by the Ground Zero Mosque is not one of religious freedom. Of course, Muslims have a right to build mosques and worship in them. Rather, the issue is whether it is right to have a mosque and Islamic center in virtually the exact spot where so many Americans were killed in the name of Islamic holy war. I don't think it is right, any more than I would support the idea of a neo-Nazi recruiting center at Auschwitz. My sympathies in this case are not with religiously deprived Muslims, but rather with Deborah Burlingame, a spokesperson for a 9/11 victims group. "Barack Obama has abandoned America at the place where America's heart was broken 9 years ago," she said. Some supporters of the mosque, such as New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, clearly missed the distinction being made here between the right to worship and how and where that right is exercised. Fareed Zakaria, the writer and CNN host, recognizes the distinction. Even so, he argues in favor of the mosque on the grounds that the folks building it are traditional Muslims who have condemned terrorism. Still, it's not clear why these moderate Muslims disregarded the sentiments of 9/11 victims' families and decided on a site so close to Ground Zero. Undoubtedly, radical Muslims around the world will view the mosque as a kind of triumphal monument. There is a historical precedent for this. Muslims have a long tradition of building monuments to commemorate triumphs over adversaries, as when they built the Dome of the Rock on the site of Solomon's Temple, or when Mehmet the Conqueror rode his horse into the Byzantine church Hagia Sophia and declared that it would be turned into a mosque. Many Americans do not know this history, but the radical Muslims do, and Obama does as well. The radical Muslims would like the Ground Zero Mosque built so it can stand as an enduring symbol of resistance to American power, and President Obama evidently agrees with them. My confidence in the anti-colonial model emboldens me to make 3 specific predictions about Obama's future conduct. The first prediction concerns deficit reduction. Obama's position has been that we need to spend trillions right now, but once the economy recovers, it will be time to get serious about deficit reduction. Now, there is one kind of deficit reduction that Obama clearly likes: tax increases on the rich. Already, he has announced that he is going to let the Bush tax cuts lapse, at least for the higher brackets. But of course, deficits can also be reduced through spending cuts. Since I don't think Obama cares about deficits per se, only about reducing concentrations of power and wealth in America, I do not expect to see any significant spending reductions during an Obama administration. Cutting spending is simply not a priority for the anti-colonial agenda. Second, I predict that even as Iran develops the full capacity to build nuclear weapons, Obama will do little or nothing to stop it. My theory holds that Obama has no serious interest in preventing Iran from having a bomb. His main concern is with reducing the American arsenal. Therefore, I believe that the Obama administration will huff and puff and take all kinds of meaningless steps, but no effective action, to actually prevent Iran from reaching its nuclear objective. Of course, it is possible that Israel will launch airstrikes to disable the Iranian nuclear facilities, but in this case, I predict the Obama administration will do its best to prevent Israel from taking any such action. From the anti-colonial point of view, an Israeli strike would be an unconscionable act of aggression against a country that is only seeking something that Israel and the West already possess. My third prediction is more risky, because it relies on the political atmosphere being favorable to Obama and unfavorable to the military. If that becomes the case, then I predict that Obama will go beyond his attempt to try terrorists and foreign captives in civilian courts. He will initiate procedures to try U.S. military officers and soldiers for war crimes committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Right now, this is politically impossible, but the atmosphere can change quickly if there are more Abu Ghraib-type scandals that provoke public outrage. I suspect that Obama is looking for something like this to launch an all-out campaign against the military. So if the circumstances permit him to do it, I believe that Obama will do it. This would be his way to call the colonial occupation forces to account. Throughout this book, I have been outlining the formulation of Obama's anti-colonial ideology and showing the harmful impact of that ideology on America's economy and America's position in the world. But this is to judge Obama on terms that he would not accept. In this final chapter, I intend to assess Obama's anti-colonialism on its own terms.